Well, good evening one and all, and a very warm welcome to Dr. Rock's radio show here on msiradio.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com. Well, after last week's show on lucid dreaming, meditation and the single point meditation and the like, this week we've got a recorded conversation with Serena Roney-Dougal, whose professional life has been spent doing parapsychological or psi research. She's got a PhD in it as well. A lady that I met a couple of times earlier this year and listened to a pair of very interesting talks she did. We did plan to do a live chat, but unfortunately that turned out not to be possible due to a bit of diary confusion. Such is the way of things, seems to happen quite a lot. But nonetheless, it's a pretty interesting interview, I think. We're going to be looking a little bit as well into her book, Where Science and Magic Meet, which is a truly fantastic tome, right up my street. I must admit, it's been a subject of interest of mine for quite a long time now, because since I started looking into history and science and the nature of the mind, the two things have really been merging quite well, I think, and continue to do so, as far as I can tell. It seems that science is really, really seriously catching up with the mystics after it's only taken them a few thousand years, and physics is becoming pretty much a meditation for the people that are studying it. I'd like to start, though, by way of introduction, by playing a podcast that I played quite a while back now. It's only about 9 minutes long, I think, and it's called The Stupidity Hypothesis. It concerns psi, intuition, and the like, because it seems to me that however real science seems to be finding it, there's still many, many people who are extremely dubious about the existence of things such as telepathy and telekinesis and the rest. And I think that Dean Radin from the Institute of Noetic Sciences actually sums it up pretty well. I'm going to have to push a few extra buttons to get this to work, but hopefully it'll all be fine. So it's just a quick intro, really, to tonight's subject matter, which will include the interview, and probably I'll dip into the book a little bit as well, because obviously in an hour or so's interview we can't really cover anything like the whole thing. But hopefully coming up shortly will be Dean Radin, The Stupidity Hypothesis.
Most scientists go through conventional training. They go through 20 years of school. Most scientists will never hear anything about psychic phenomena in their academic training. Except maybe they'll hear about it and say, well, you can dismiss that because it's been proven to be all delusion and fraud. And that's all they know. So if somebody then claims that there is evidence for this, they will, of course, think that that's nonsense because they went through this training and they never heard anything about it. Or they heard worse, that there's something there, but it was all denied. So this has led within an orthodox science, within mainstream science, to the notion that people who believe in psychic phenomena are stupid. And what they mean by that is that they are not trained in the principles of science to be able to understand why such phenomena can't be true. So I call this the stupidity hypothesis. It's a testable hypothesis because what it says is, if you look at the number of years of education that somebody has, there should be a negative correlation with the degree of belief in psychic phenomena. The more educated you are, the less you would believe. And this is the assertion that many skeptics will say. In fact, the National Science Foundation says this, essentially. They bemoan the fact of science education being so poor in the United States, and this is why people believe in lots of nonsense. Well, some of that is true. People are not very well educated in science, but they include in the mix psychic phenomena as an example of one of the crazy things that people believe because they're stupid. If you look at the actual data, you look at the survey data, and you partition it by the number of years of education versus belief in things like ESP. It is not a negative correlation. And in fact, it's a significant positive correlation. What does that mean? That means that the more educated you are, the more likely you are going to believe in psychic phenomena. So in other words, you can test the stupidity hypothesis and it fails. And you do the same sort of analysis and you do surveys for college professors. What percentage of college professors believe in things psychic? 60 to 70%. Well, they're not stupid. So the ignorance spin that is put on this is absolutely not true. So there needs to be other ways of understanding. Well, then what are they believing in? Why do they believe in this stuff? Mainstream science says it couldn't possibly exist, but it's based on a false premise that it couldn't exist. Why do they believe? Most people believe in something even when science says it can't be so, because of their own experience, their personal experience. And so you can kind of make a guess that people who are not very well educated can be deluded into believing things, even though science says you shouldn't believe it, because they don't have the critical thinking apparatus in order to figure out what might be coincidence and what might be wishful thinking and so on. But that is not the case when you have highly sophisticated psychologists, for example, or other kinds of scientists who spend their lives critically thinking about things. If you start denying your own experience, that's like one step in the nut house. You can't deny your own experience. So scientists, like many people, will become schizophrenic. They have personal, private beliefs that are developed because of their experience, but they don't talk about it in public. Because in public, at least within the academic world, you're not supposed to talk about it. And this is one of the few areas in academia where this taboo is not only strong, but has persisted for at least a century, probably more than a century. I know many, many academic colleagues. These are distinguished people in their fields, in psychology, cognitive neuroscience, the basic neurosciences, physics, and so on, who privately are very, very interested in these phenomena, like psi phenomena. Some of them are doing their own experiments. Some of them are getting successful results in their experiments. Well, why aren't we hearing about it? Because the culture in the academic world says you cannot talk about it. So we're living in the parable of the emperor's new clothes. It's something that everybody knows, but cannot speak about it. So just from a purely sociological point of view, this is so interesting. You have this completely schizophrenic split between experiences which happen repeatedly and have throughout time and to all kinds of people, including college professors, and then you have to officially deny it. So because I've noticed in the last decade or so that the number of academics that are interested in these topics but have been quiet is getting larger and larger. And I'm not exactly sure why. The times have changed. There's new openness to new ideas. Maybe because the idea of mind-body connections is no longer considered a lunatic fringe, but is mainstream, that people are more open to new ideas. So this is like a new ancient idea that now it's becoming not quite, you still can't quite be public about it, but the number of people has grown, so there's a restlessness which is occurring. And I'm the lightning rod for it. I get contacted by these people all the time and telling me their secret interest in it. And I say, well, did you know that so-and-so in the same department where you are is interested in this? And they say, really? I never knew. And then they start collaborating. And there's an invisible college that's beginning to evolve of its own accord. So I'm projecting that within 5 or 10 years, perhaps, that the invisible college will grow so large and the pressure will be so large that the taboo will be addressed. I mean, even at this point, the taboo is so strong, you're not even supposed to talk about the taboo. It's like a highly secret government project where the fact of the existence of the project is secret. Well, the taboo is secret. No one's supposed to talk about it. Once the taboo is addressed, that's the first stage in making it dissolve. And at that point, you will find an enormous amount of interest in studying these things within mainstream science. And I've known this has been the case for at least 20 years. 20 years ago, I would give a talk to a group of technical people and scientists. And being out of that culture, at the very beginning, I'll say something like, you know, they're all expectantly waiting to hear what I'm going to talk about. And I'll say, I know what you're thinking. And of course, they all laugh. And what you're thinking is, why am I talking to a scientific and technical audience about something which you only know from the entertainment world? Psychic phenomena, after all. And the reason I'm talking to you about it is because when you look around, you'll find that it's standing room only. And this is among scientists and technical people in a technical environment. Well, why is it standing room only? Because everybody's interested in it. Most people in a positive direction, some in a negative, but they're still interested. What other area of science do we know where there's enormous amount of interest and nobody doing anything about it? So I say at the end of the talk, if there was funding, there's federal funding, funding from your company, wherever it happens to be, that allowed you to do this without risk to your career, how many of you would like to do this research by raising your hand? Almost everybody. I mean, so I present the issue back to them saying, well, why am I different? The only thing that makes me different from you is that I was willing to take a risk. Because I'm interested just like you are, except that, you know, I'm willing to say, well, it seems more interesting to me than things like having a very secure career, because ultimately our lives last that long, and, you know, do something interesting. That's my philosophy. So that's part of the way that I see what is happening in terms of this taboo, which has persisted and needs to break.
So that was Dean Radin talking about the current state of Psi research and how quickly things are changing. He made at the beginning some pretty vital points that fundamentally the academic world approaches the whole thing with denial, really. And one of the things that becomes clear when you start looking into these things is that the better the results are and the more carefully controlled the experiments are, then the more likely the individuals that are running the experiments are to be accused of delusion and fraud, even though they're following the carefully prescribed scientific method, because in the hope, presumably, of actually breaking through this kind of wall. And it seems quite clear from what Dean was saying there that education fundamentally deludes many people on this subject. Mainstream science says it can't exist. Well, that's no longer the case, as we'll find out hopefully as the show goes on. Mainstream science says quite the opposite. In fact, Serena makes the point that if we hadn't read about sorcery and magic in our myths and our fairy tales and all the other sources they come to us in, then we would have to deduce that they exist from some of the things that modern science is discovering. There's also the problem, I think, that fundamentally science regards the clinical as true and the anecdotal as untrue. And one of the things about parapsychology or psychic research or whatever we want to call it is that there is a huge amount of common anecdote. The Institute for Psychical Research gets many, many, many reports of especially precognition, apparently, coming to them really pretty regularly. It is something that is common to all of us. I think there might also be a bit of a difficulty sometimes in getting it to manifest for various reasons in a clinical situation. The point that Radin made about scientists believing one thing when they're in the laboratory and another thing when they're at home is something that Rupert Sheldrake's also pretty strong on. He reckons that that there's many scientists out there now who are paid to do one thing. He points out that your famous man who says that we're all kind of basically genetic robots doesn't believe when he gets home that his wife's a robot or that his dog's a robot. It's just something that he's kind of, I don't know, getting his funding for, getting paid to support, whatever it is. It's not something that, it's almost like the science has been separated from the everyday life. And as Radin says, the number of people who believe is getting larger and larger. And I think that Rupert Sheldrake proposes that it may well be over 50% of scientists who are operating on this kind of level. And really that means, as Dean Radin suggests, that when the breakthrough comes, it's really going to be quite sudden and quite large, because there's already a load of people on one side of the seesaw who are kind of pretending to be on the other side, and there is a restlessness occurring, like there's an invisible college. I love that idea. And these are the kind of things that we're going to be looking at, because of course Serena is one of the people who has spent, she got a PhD in it, as I say, and then set up a company to do psychical research, and that's what she's been doing for her working life. And so we're actually going to get to hear from one of these people who's been battering at a wall, which seems to me is rapidly crumbling. It's interesting that her book is labelled on the back. It says science stroke new science. So we can straight away see that there's a difference between the two things. And it says, the root of the word science is knowledge. The root of the word magic is wisdom. Serena blends these two spheres of human experience and shows how the latest scientific research and parapsychological study interact. The quantum view of matter is overturning the traditional worldview, and the fantastic discoveries being made bring new insights into the connections between all forms of magic and science. We share the exciting results of her research on the scientific validation of psychic phenomena, drawing on her groundbreaking work on the pineal gland, something called the third eye, and the phenomenon of second sight. She shows that the greatest implication of psychic phenomena is that each of us is potentially aware of the natural magic of our earth and of everything in the universe. And actually, it's got a comment on the back by Dean Radin as well, which is what reminded me of the stupidity hypothesis. He says, where science and magic meet is a clearly written, mind-expanding and compelling exploration of reality at the mysterious boundaries between mind and matter, which is exactly what it is. It's a really fine read and very easily written as well. I can recommend it to anybody who likes reading. If we have a little quote before I go into the interview from a man called Paul Davis. He says, over 50 years ago, something strange happened in physical science. Bizarre and stunning new ideas about space and time, mind and matter erupted among the scientific community. Only now are these ideas beginning to reach the general public. Concepts that have intrigued and inspired physicists themselves for two generations are at last gaining the attention of ordinary people who never suspected that a major revolution in human thought had occurred. The new physics has come of age, so we got physics and new physics too. In the first quarter of this century, two momentous theories were proposed, the theory of relativity and the quantum theory. From them sprang most of 20th century physics, but the new physics soon revealed more than simply a better model of the physical world. Physicists began to realise that their discoveries demanded a radical reformulation of the most fundamental aspects of reality. They learned to approach their subject in totally unexpected and novel ways that seemed to turn common sense on its head and find closer accord with mysticism than materialism, which is, I guess, where we're all going. So here we've got it. It's somewhere a little bit over an hour of a conversation that I recorded earlier on this afternoon. And I suspect that we'll hopefully be hearing from Serena again. But this is Serena Rooney-Dougal chatting with Dr. Rock over what appears to be quite a sound Skype collection. I'll be back with you shortly. Or longly, as the case may be. Hello again, Serena.
I'm here.
Thanks very much for agreeing to this chat. I've been really looking forward to it.
Oh, you're welcome.
I don't think there's any way I can hope to cover all of the stuff that you've got in your book there, but I thought that if it's all right with you, what I'd like to do is sort of start with a bit of a chat about you and how you got to be doing what you're doing, and about the nature of psi, just because it's pretty rare for us to get a chance to talk to somebody who's actually looking into it professionally, and then move into your own research, if that's okay.
Yep, that sounds fine.
So, you are a pretty rare animal, aren't you? I gather that there's only about 40 PhDs in psi research in the UK. How did it come about that you ended up doing that?
Yeah, I think there's a few more now since Bob Morris was working at the Kursler Parapsychology Unit in Edinburgh, and I think he alone had about 40 people doing PhDs. And since then, some of those have become lecturers at university, and they've had their own PhD students. So I think the number's sort of grown to about 80 in Britain now. And that's so we're not quite as rare as we used to be. When I got my PhD, there were only about a dozen or 15. It was very few.
Presumably it was quite easy to get at one then, was it?
It was very, very rare, and I was very fortunate in that I had been doing parapsychology undergraduate degree at University College London, and in my second year they had a two-week lab class on parapsychology, which don't quite know why they did it. I don't think they ever did it again. And there was one of the lecturers there was Professor Norman Dixon, who was one of the leading researchers into subliminal perception. And he was very open-minded. And he let me do my final year project comparing subliminal perception with telepathy. And I don't know whether they ever let that happen again at UCL, but anyway, I managed to do it. And he then went on to supervise my PhD, which wasn't at UCL. They wouldn't let me do PhD in parapsychology there. But I managed to get into City University, where there was the head of the engineering department was a member of the Society for Psychic Research. So he sort of twisted the arm of the head of the psychology department to let me in. And one of Norman Dixon's ex-PhD students was now a lecturer there, and he took me in under his wing, even though he wasn't my supervisor. Norman Dixon was my supervisor. So it was all very irregular.
It's interesting that it was an engineer that got you in on that, or isn't it?
It was an engineer who got me in, and my supervisor was at UCL, not at City University. It was merely one of his ex-PhD students who was there in a lecturer who took me in under his name. So very, very, very irregular, but I managed to get there. Unfortunately, that guy left after a couple of years, and I got given another lecturer to be my nominal supervisor, but she was a bit, you see, most psychologists are a bit anti-parapsychology, and she was too. So in the end, the head of department said to me, either I stopped doing parapsychology or I had to leave the university. They couldn't actually get rid of me as a PhD student. Once you're in, you're in. But by depriving me of a supervisor, essentially, I had to leave, and I found Terence Lee at Surrey University, who had two PhD students doing parapsychology at the time, and he took me in under his wing and really, really helped. He was wonderful. That's how I got my PhD in the end, was with his support.
But it was
tricky, very tricky. It took about 10 years because I was doing it part-time as I had children, single parenting two girls. So it took me a long time, and as you hear, it was going from one place to another and basically working on my own doing it without really much help at all, but I got there.
Yeah, I guess, as is so often the case, it's synchronicity, making sure that we're in the right place at the right time.
Yes, there was a lot of synchronicity involved.
So how would you define parapsychology?
Oh, that's easy. It's the scientific research into psychic phenomena. Psychic phenomena are phenomena like telepathy, clairvoyance, precognition, which are phenomena occurring without using the known senses, or in terms of psychokinesis, without actually direct physical action. So we're talking mental abilities.
So if we just have a quick look at those sort of four subsections, if you like, telepathy, I came across that, I guess, in terms of science when I was talking to Rupert Sheldrake and his research into the sense of being stared at, which seems to be pretty widespread.
Yes, and there, of course, you're talking about a body response. And a lot of modern parapsychology is looking at the unconscious levels by which we pick up the psychic phenomena. And the body is very sensitive, and there's many different ways in which we measure body response, but the simplest is the skin conductance response, which is, people will have heard of the lie detector from the 70s and 80s. And it's where the palms of your hands sweat in response to an emotional stimulus. And it was used a lot in subliminal perception research as well. And from it came the basis of subliminal advertising and all of that, and the lie detectors, I said, which doesn't work very well. But the basic premise that our hands sweat more when there is an emotional stimulus that we're not actually consciously aware of, but the body responds to. And that was what was being used in a lot of the long distance staring research, not the sort that Rupert did, which was sort of in the same room, but people who were doing it via remote CCTV from one room in one building to another room in another building. And the people who got stared at via the remote TV link, their body showed that they were aware of when the person was staring, as opposed to the control periods when the TV monitor was switched off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And what about sort of actual mind-to-mind communication? I remember reading that Edgar Mitchell did some under-the-counter research when he was on the Apollo space flights.
Well, yes, that's the furthest it's ever been done. And actually, I think he was doing clairvoyance rather than telepathy. He was sort of trying to guess decks of cards, that level of stuff. But because those results were so successful and he became really intrigued with what was going on, he set up the Institute for Noetic Sciences in California, which is where a lot of parapsychology research is still carrying on.
Yes, they've had some very interesting results, haven't they, with sort of meditating on people who are being healed?
There's the healing research that's been done, not particularly at IONS, but yes, in California. What they're doing in IONS at the moment, which is really interesting, is there's something in quantum physics called the double slit experiment, which is where you let off, let's say, a particle, say a photon of light. And if you just let the photon beam go, you will get the normal interference pattern of a wave. If you cover one of the slits, then what you get is something like a particle going through. So this is the whole particle wave phenomenon of quantum physics. And what they're doing now is they're having people telepathically watching. And they are finding that just to have a they're working with meditators, but to have a meditator actually concentrate on this double slit experiment will affect the particle in terms of whether it becomes a particle or a wave. So this is what's known as the observer effect in quantum physics and the collapse of the wave function and all of that stuff. And their research is suggesting that consciousness, mind, at a distance, you know, not actually physically there, will affect the collapse of the wave function and determine whether the photon acts as a particle or a wave. Very interesting work.
That's Dean Radin's
experiments.
Yeah, that is interesting, isn't it? Because I know that to start with, they set up physical measurement devices to try and find out what was going on there. But the fact that just the mind, so it is just the observer there making the difference.
Mm-hmm.
Is remote viewing just a modern word for what we would have used to have called clairvoyance?
Yes, it is. Well, remote viewing is a particular methodology of clairvoyance. So the normal clairvoyance experiments would be where, let's say, in the computer, there are four possible pictures that you're trying to pick up, let's say, using the Ganzfeld design. And then, you know, you have your experience and you draw it out and you write it down and you talk about it to someone. Then you get to see the four possible pictures and you choose yourself which one you think was the target based on your experience. What they do in remote viewing is the person has, you know, their attempt to pick up on the target and to draw it out. Then they get to see just the target itself. But their description, their verbal description, their pictorial description is then sent off to an independent judge who sees all the four possible targets and has to choose out the actual target from the description of the other person. So it's like a more of a two-stage process. And some people prefer this because they say that giving just the target feedback to the observer is better because they don't have all the decoys. Other people say it's worse because you've now got the judge's psychic ability muddying the picture. So there's pros and cons with the two different methodologies, but the remote viewing methodology is the one that uses the psychic observer and the judge, as opposed to just having the psychic observer being their own judge.
Okay, and there have been some pretty successful investigations of that, haven't they? Again, I remember reading about, was his name Russell Targ?
Yes, he was the one who started that whole protocol in the early days at SRI in California. That's in the early 70s.
Mm-hmm. And what about precognition? Is anybody doing any work into that? Because that must be a lot more difficult to pin down, really, because it's a sort of feeling that somebody gets, isn't it, that somebody might have died or that somebody's going to call or whatever. Have we got any evidence as to how common that is in people?
Oh, yes, there's been lots and lots of precognition research. And in fact, there's now one thought in psychic research that all psychic experiences are, in fact, precognition, and that they might manifest in different ways. But actually, it's the point of feedback, the point of when you know that your experience really happened or really is happening, that is the actual thing. And there's no essential difference between precognition and clairvoyance and telepathy. Now, that theoretical idea has been around since the 30s, actually, a long time. It's only in terms of people's psychology that precognition is thought to be trickier because it hasn't yet happened. But there's actually quite a lot of evidence now building to suggest that in fact all psychic phenomena are essentially precognitive, that it's the moment of feedback that's the crucial thing.
Okay, that kind of relates it all with time, doesn't it?
It certainly does. Yes, yes. What is time? And you see, in quantum physics, time going forwards and time going backwards is in all the equations. It's only in our actual lived experience that we have only the forward time. And yet, if you think of the number of people, you know, if you look at the psychic research societies and they get people writing in with their spontaneous experiences, and you will find that the majority of these psychic experiences that they write in about are actually precognitive ones. And that, again, is mostly at sleep and dream. So we dream something and then that dream comes true. And so these big experiences that make people go, what's happening? I need to talk with somebody about it. And they write in to the societies are in the main precognitive. So precognition is, in fact, very, very common. And the perceived unusualness of it is only because we find it very difficult to understand how we can pick up on something that hasn't yet happened.
Yeah. And you classify telepathy, clairvoyance and precognition as receptive modes, as it were, which will become important later on when we talk about your research. I'm also interested in the active one, in psychokinesis, because that's actually physically affecting physical objects in the world, isn't it, using mental abilities?
Well, this is where Rupert Sheldrake's remote staring comes in that you mentioned earlier. That was part of a whole line of research called DMILS, Distant Mental Influence on Living Systems.
Yeah.
And that research was started again in the 70s. William Broad and Marilyn Schlitz did a lot of work on DMILS, working with all sorts of different systems, but ending up with people and then being affected by being looked at from a camera from a distance. But most of this psychokinesis research is done with healing studies, which, again, you mentioned earlier. So there's been big, large-scale healing studies. People in cardiac hospitals who've had a heart attack, and they're being prayed for by different groups. There was an AIDS study, again, all with really quite strong, significant results. And it's been done not just with people, but for instance, I did work with seeds on an organic farm, and a number of the seeds were blessed by a healer. And we found, we did this for 3 years with like thousands of plants, finding that the blessed seeds grew bigger, were less susceptible to fungal damage. And with seeds, you can't say it's a psychology thing. You know, what is happening really is an influence from the healer on the plant.
That's a really important kind of discovery, isn't it, really? Because it does suggest pretty heavily that our state of mind, our attitude really makes a difference to how things fall out.
Yeah, so somebody with green fingers, you know, is somebody who has this natural innate ability to affect things. And of course, that can be used for good or bad, as Larry Dossey has pointed out in his book, you know, Be Careful What You Pray For. Because we all know about things like hex death and voodoo, and it's very real. And we can either send out positive and affect people, you know, in a very positive way, or in a similar way, we can be negative in our thoughts. And if you're angry with somebody, and at one level, you are literally physically affecting that person. So the whole Buddhist creed of right thought becomes very, very important.
Mm. Yeah. Also, I guess it plays into the placebo and its shadow counterpart, the nocebo, as well, doesn't it? How your doctor approaches you is going to make a lot of difference to what happens.
Yes, and how you consider the medicine. You know, where it's both the doctor and you thinking this is going to be the cure. And it's maybe in most cases not actually the medicine itself. It's the positive healing thoughts that you have and your doctor and your family all have.
Yeah. Before we leave psychokinesis, what about the there's two things that spring to my mind. One is the kind of sensational reports we get of poltergeists every now and then, although I haven't seen any recently, I've read a bit about them. And also the Victorians' interest in physical mediums, there seem to be some pretty spectacular and well-attested reports on those.
Yes, there are. The poltergeist is interesting, this, because there's some periods when you get lots of poltergeist effects and others when you don't. And one of the factors that relates to this is actually the Earth's magnetic activity. And it seems to be that when the sun is very active and there's lots of solar flares creating geomagnetic storms on the Earth, that these are correlated with greater incidences of things like poltergeist activity. So the fact of it not happening very much at the moment is actually we've been through a real solar minimum. The sun's been at its lowest level of sunspot and solar storm activity in the last 100 years. So since measurements began in Victorian times, they've never seen the magnetic activity at such a low level. So this could be one of the factors that is connected with the fact that there haven't been many poltergeist reports of recent years. A few, but not strong ones, and not, whereas back in the 70s and 80s there were lots.
Right. I suppose this might be a good time to talk about the investigation you made into that during this solar minimum.
Well, this is the latest work that I've been doing up at Sammy Ling, and this is how I know the solar activity affecting the Earth's magnetic field was so low, because we were just stunned when we got all the data through from the Geological Observatory in Eskdale Muir. We were hoping to do a longitudinal study going from minimum to more or less maximum. That's 5.5 years normally from minimum to maximum. We started at the minimum, and what we had over 4 years was the activity going down and down and down to this lowest point. And then by the end of 4 years, it had come back up to the normal minimum, but no way did we get to see changes from minimum to maximum as we'd been hoping for. So we've got a good baseline for, you know, psychic phenomena at a very unusual period in time, but there's not much else really we can say about it.
So what sort of investigations were you doing with the people at Samu Ling?
Well, we were looking at precognition, actually, mainly, and although, interestingly, I mean, in light of our discussion before, the program at random either chose the target at the beginning of the session or after the person had made their choice. So it was either clairvoyance or precognition. Neither I nor the person knew which sessions were which. And we found that actually no significant difference between the two. It looks like it's one form of psi. And there's nothing to separate clairvoyance, precognition. And what I had was people who were advanced meditators. They'd done minimum of 10 years practice, and lots of them had done 4-year retreats and had done 30, 35. I think the oldest practitioner had done 50 years of practice. And they were doing this classic free response design where they meditated, they tried to become aware of a target picture, or actually we were using 1-minute video clips that they were going to see at the very end of the session. They then drew this out. They then described it verbally to me. They then got to see all 4 video clips, and they chose which one they thought was the target on the basis of their experience. Then they got to see the actual target. So absolute classic free response design, which we used because when we originally did this work, I was working in India with yogis and with Tibetan Buddhist monks. And this sort of thing where you try to see something that's then going to happen, a bit like the Tibetans choosing the next Dalai Lama. They would go to the Oracle Lake. They would look into the lake. They would see the picture, the farmhouse by the mountain. Then they would travel through Tibet looking to find the actual farmhouse and mountain, which was connected with the next Dalai Lama. So they considered this what they call Mo divination, mirror Mo divination. And so for them to have the black computer screen that they could look into in order to try and see the picture, then to have the choice of the 4 that they've got, you know, all the decoys, but this is like real life. Is it this one? Is it that one? No, it's closest actually to this one, and then choosing that one. So we used a traditional technique and turned it into a laboratory scientific experiment with a laptop, which was quite good fun, actually.
Yeah. Oh, and did you find there was a significant difference between the people who'd done lots of meditation and the people who'd done very little?
With the yogis and with the Tibetan Buddhists, yes, we did. We did 4 experiments, and we got strong correlations, both with years of practice and increasing psychic scoring. And also we separated people into different groups. So there were the students who'd done very little work. There were people with some degree of initiation. In one lot, it was what were called sannyasins. And then there were the people who were fully initiated, the lamas or the swamis. And they were the ones who really showed the strongest psychic experiences, psychic ability.
That's brilliant, isn't it? That's really brilliant, because it suggests that that somehow these people are genuinely tuning into something which the rest of us are being, well, not only not tuning into, but being pretty effectively distracted from. What do you think it is that they're tuning into?
Yeah, I mean, that what you see, the theory here is that you know, the traditions, both the Buddhist and the yogic, say, as you attain to a level of meditation known as samadhi, so the psychic experiences start to happen. So they've got this in their teachings. And the research is too preliminary at the moment. We haven't actually looked into what is it about meditation. But my feeling at the moment, just from this very preliminary work, is that as you learn to still the mind, as you learn to stop the chatter of the thoughts, so you become more sensitive, more aware at the subtler levels of your mind. And it's at these subtler levels of mind that the psychic information is coming through on. So we're not talking about senses. The senses overlay this subtle level of mind. The senses are so strong that they drown out anything else. But with meditation, you're learning to quiet all of that, and to go beyond the normal thought sense processes into this other level of awareness, and that's what is the key thing. And the Tibetans consider that a trained lama or trained Rinpoche, who's done the years of practice in meditation, who's attained to really good, clear meditation, that their clairvoyance, their psychic ability will be 100% reliable. You can really trust. If you go to the Dalai Lama for something, he can do it. Whereas your normal village person, they might be the local psychic, the local wise woman, but they're not 100% reliable. They might be pretty darn good. They might be worth going to, but they're not going to get the same quality as you get from the really trained meditator.
So what we're saying is they're somehow developing what we might call the sixth sense to be as reliable as, say, their eyesight or their touch is to the rest of us.
Yes, and it's probably better not to think of it as a sense. There's lots of subliminal senses, like our sensitivity to the Earth's magnetic field, which is an actual sense. We are sensing this. Whereas when we're talking about the psychic ability, it's a sensitivity, but it's more of an awareness or a perception, which is not an actual sense.
Okay. So what sort of things make difference to our, apart from meditation, what sort of things make a difference to this kind of sensitivity? Does our attitude make any difference?
Well, that was one of the first things that we found in parapsychology. That goes back to the 40s, the first research on that. And essentially, an attitude's the most important action that you can take with regard to anything in your life. And what we found is that those people who believe that psychic phenomena are possible, those people who say that during their childhood and their life they've had psychic experiences, and most importantly, those people who believe that they can be psychic, you know, at will, are the people who are going to show the strong positive scoring. On the other hand, people who don't believe in the psychic, they've never had any experiences, they don't think it can happen, they're going to show really strong scoring, but in the opposite negative direction. So they're actually going to be blocking the psychic awareness.
So that's still a statistically significant response, isn't it? So we might think that you're the artistic, open-minded or childlike people are going to end up being more sensitive, whereas analytical or logical mind is going to have that other effect you were talking about.
That's right. I mean, the way I normally describe it is if you imagine tossing a coin 100 times, calling out heads or tails, and by chance you're going to get it right 50 times, 1 in 2 chance. If you get it right 80 times, you know you're in the flow, that, you know, that's not chance. It's something exceptional to score it correctly 80 times. However, if you only score correctly 20 times, that's just as significant. There's a bit of you that's knowing and refusing to know and saying the opposite thing. And this has been found again and again and again and again in parapsychology. It's one of the most consistent and reliable results.
I think it's actually been found in some of the laboratories of the new physics as well, hasn't it? I remember that Pauli was famous for wrecking experiments just by being anywhere near them.
Yes. Yes, that's at the more spontaneous uncontrolled level. Yes.
Yeah. And what about states of consciousness? Are there times when we're likely to be more sensitive than others?
There's been a lot of research in parapsychology on this, and it started essentially with dream research, the Maimonides Dream Lab in the 70s, where they found again and again and again that people were reporting dreams that were related to the target that somebody was looking at that time. So they initially started off with the telepathy type paradigm, somebody looking at a target. They then moved on to clairvoyance and precognition type paradigms, where there was either a target chosen but not being looked at, or the target wasn't chosen till the next day or the next week later. In all of those, they got very significant results.
Right.
So this started off a whole series of experiments into altered states of consciousness, the most famous ones being what's called the Ganzfeld, which is where you sit in a comfy chair, you have headphones on with white noise, which is all the frequencies, a bit like listening to a waterfall or the seashore. And you have your eyes covered with something that's translucent. Normally they use half ping pong balls so that, you know, when you're blinking, your eyelashes aren't touching anything. You aren't being bothered. And then there'll be a red light. So you're in this pink glow with this rushing water noise. Must be a bit like being in the womb, with the pink through the flesh and the sound of the blood. And what you find in this is that you go into what's called the hypnagogic state, which is a state of consciousness that you experience just as you're falling asleep. High imagery, a bit like dreaming, but you're not dreaming. You stay awake in the Ganzfeld, you talk out your experiences, you get these dream type images. It can be very highly visual, certainly highly imagination wise. And these experiments have been run again since the later 70s, but still since the 70s, right up to the present day, all showing very strong psychic effects. People are more consistently consciously psychic in the Ganzfeld than under a normal state of consciousness.
Which takes us again to the Buddhist idea. I don't think it's only the Buddhists, but the people in the Vedas as well suggest that we're actually more conscious when we're dreaming, when we're in the in a sleeping state, than we are when we're in the waking dream, as it were.
Well, we're more conscious in the mental sense, because in those states, essentially, once again, the senses are shut off. And the sense consciousness, that our normal everyday thought consciousness, is what is called secondary processing, and the dream consciousness is what's called primary processing. And new research by neuroscientists is suggesting that this primary process dream mind is our default mind. It is our first mind. You know, babies in the womb are in REM sleep. What are they dreaming of? Because REM sleep is dream sleep. Newborn babies will dream for 70% of their sleeping time. What are they dreaming of? So this dream mind seems to be our primary mind, which is pure mind without the senses in there. And so when you are doing your meditation training and you're learning to go beyond the sense everyday thought type mind, what you're doing is initially you're slipping into this dream type mind, and then as your meditation progresses, you move into what one might call, in our understanding, the unconscious mind, the mind that we never can bring through into consciousness unless you do this advanced consciousness training known as meditation.
This subliminal mind you suggest in your book is capable possibly of remembering, or of noticing and remembering, everything.
Yes, in potential.
Yeah.
Because we're not dealing with our senses. We're not dealing with being in this see-touch realm of the present moment in the physical. We're actually shifting into what David Bohm calls the implicate order. which, or the holographic universe, which is where all is present. It's the level of eternity and infinity where there is no time. You're outside of time and space. You're in the infinite potential, what the Buddhists call emptiness, which isn't to do with nothing. It's to do with infinite potential. It's not yet in form, but it is there in potential.
Yeah. I love the quote you had in your book from Richard Gardner, from his book Evolution Through the Tarot, which said the evolutionary process will be seen to be the constant integration of the conscious mind with that of the subconscious. A really significant fusion of our dual consciousness will undoubtedly carry with it magical powers and a tremendous increase in understanding.
Yes, well, these are the ideas of most mystics and teachers of higher consciousness, both East and West.
Yeah, which is, to a great extent, there seems to me to be a feeling that that's what's happening to us now, that kind of fusion is becoming more common.
Whether it's becoming more common, I really wouldn't want to say at the moment. I've had periods of great hope when I thought that was happening, and then I have periods where hope is a pretty poisonous meal, and it's better just to stick with the everyday because it doesn't look so hopeful. So at this moment in time, I really wouldn't want to say whether I think there's an evolution in consciousness that way or not. I'm not in quite such a positive frame of mind about humanity right now.
No, I can see what you mean. I can absolutely see what you mean. Just to return to the subject of dreaming for a moment, you were part of Paul Devereaux's Dragon Project, weren't you? Dreaming at sacred sites.
Yes, I dreamt up at Carn Ingli, Hill of the Angels, which is one of the highest points of the Pwllheli Hills in southwest Wales, which is highly magnetic. So you take a compass up there and it literally spins round. The rocks are so strongly magnetic. And I had two nights up there. It was the August full moon. And actually the moon was at its fullest in the middle of the day between the two nights that I was there. So essentially I had full moon for both nights, one coming into the full and one just leaving the full. And I didn't leave the top of the hill for that whole period. So I went up in the afternoon. I had the first night up there, which was full of visions rather than much sleep. I stayed up there the whole of the next day. And then I had the next night, and then I came down the following day. So it was a very intense, unforgettable experience.
Yeah, I stayed recently at a place in the Glastonbury Zodiac, which is actually right at the centre of the Zodiac, where a whole load of lays meet. And I got over that. A couple of weeks, I got very little sleep at all. I was dreaming all the time.
So that would be Park Wood?
It was close by. It was at a place called Barton St David.
Oh, well, Barton St David's not actually in... I used to live in Barton St David. That's where my second daughter was born. Park Wood is the centre of the Zodiac.
Right. Okay. It certainly seemed to make a lot of difference to me because I have to concentrate on remembering my dreams normally, and I certainly didn't when I was there.
Yeah. Well, you know, this whole... Isle of Avalon, Vale of Avalon is a very special place to be.
What is it, do you think, that makes it so special?
The land. There's some places where the land has a very strong energy. So Mount Kailash is the one in Tibet that the Tibetans consider to be their most sacred mountain, where the energies are the strongest. Here in Britain, you know, the Avalon, the Tor and the area around it is very strong as well. It's in the nature of the land.
Right. What about archetypes and symbols and dreams? Because they seem to be fairly closely connected as well.
Yes. Well, when you do big dreaming, then you're connecting with the archetypal layer of consciousness. And this is the consciousness that I was describing earlier as the holographic all is one, the mystical consciousness where you are outside of this everyday space and time. And the archetypes are outside space and time. So I could take a mythology from the Babylonians of Inanna, who is queen of heaven, but she goes down into the underworld, down into the depths where she's stripped and hung up on a hook like a piece of meat and has to be rescued to come out again. And that's from 6,000 years ago, but we can resonate with that myth today. So a modern thing would be, I don't know, Fungus a Bogeyman or something coming out of the gutter as, you know, this really nasty smelly thing. Or there's so many mythologies where you go down into the underworld. This is an archetype of the soul's journey, of that which is not to do with our present everyday lives, but is to do with this other level of reality.
Yeah. So might we think from this that, I don't know, that the universe, the cosmos that we're living in is kind of more of the nature of mind than it is of matter. Perhaps the underworld is the material world that we find ourselves in.
At the moment, I've been working with the Buddhist viewpoint, so that's what I'm thinking about at the moment, which isn't to say that it will always be, and I will probably change and change as I grow and learn and discover. But at the moment, I reckon that both matter and mind are primary, that you cannot say matter is primary, as the materialists say, nor can you say that mind is primary, as, let's say, the Hindu Vedic tradition says, but that the two, both mind and matter, are primary together, as you get in, let's say, the Kashmiri Shaivite tradition, where it's Shiva Shakti, Shiva consciousness, Shakti energy, vibration, and it's the interaction of the two that is the universe as we know it. At its grossest level, it's the physical, but then there are the subtler levels, which are what we've been talking about. And you cannot at any point, so like in those Yab Yum statues of the god and the goddess in union, that's what we're talking about. It's the interaction of the two that creates the universe as we know it.
Right. Certainly the double slit experiment seems to imply that fairly heavily.
Yes, it does.
And is there, I mean, when we're talking about these capabilities, is there a noticeable difference between men and women?
Some research shows gender differences and other doesn't. Traditionally, in the British culture anyway, we've considered it to be more of a female trait, but I do think that we've got heavy cultural overlays here, because if you go to, let's say, the South American tradition, that the shamanic traditions have been primarily men, the same in Africa. So traditionally, there are some places where it's men and some places where it's women. And I do suspect that culture has a huge part to play in all of these, just as psychology has a huge part to play in whether we think clairvoyance is easier than precognition.
Right. Yeah, fair enough. So what about your research? Where did you start off once you'd got your qualifications? What did you do next?
So I started off with the comparing subliminal perception with psychic awareness. Then I moved into exploring the pineal gland and its role in psychic awareness. Then I moved on to the lettuce experiments, working with the healer blessing the crops on the organic farm. Then I went to India and I did the research into meditation, and then I did the Sammy Ling work looking at the effect of the Earth's magnetic field.
Right. So what about the pineal research? Where were things when you started looking into that?
Okay, so this started in the late 70s. It was another little bit of synchronicity where I met somebody who was doing research into psychoactive plants, and they told me about ayahuasca and about Claudio Naranjo, a Chilean psychotherapist who considered that ayahuasca took you into this level of the collective unconscious, the archetypal realm that we've mentioned, and suggested that it might work because it was mimicking something made possibly by the pineal gland. So this information tweaked my curiosity, because I was at the time studying yoga meditation at the Satchinanda Yoga Center in London. And Swami Satchinanda, the founder of this school of yoga, was, like the Dalai Lama, very interested in linking science and spirituality. And he'd written a book about Agya Chakra, which is the third eye chakra center, the psychic center. And he had said that the physical aspect of Agya Chakra was in the pineal gland, which is right in the center of the brain. So I had two converging points, one from ayahuasca and one from yoga, suggesting that the pineal gland was a place to look at. So not knowing anything about biochemistry, neurochemistry, neuroscience, any of that, I dived in to looking at this. And fortunately, one of the participants in my PhD research was actually studying neurochemistry at a hospital in London, and he fished out whatever papers came his way to do with the pineal gland. And I discovered it was actually a very, very active gland. It makes melatonin, which we all know in terms of the biological clock and jet lag and getting depressed in the winter. But what fewer people know is that the pineal gland, through its action on melatonin, is actually the off switch for all of the hormones in the body. And when we look at where the hormones are being produced, they actually happen to be the chakra points. So we're looking at a hormonal system linking with a spiritual system.
Yeah,
and
that's
the pineal gland is the off switch for this.
Because the chakra system, or at least the 7-point chakra system, because there's several different ones, aren't there? Isn't there an endocrine organ for each of the energetic chakra centres?
Well, I'm looking at the traditional yogic chakra system, which is the 7 chakras, yes. Yeah. This is the 4,000-year-old yogic system, which you read about when you read the traditional yoga books.
Right.
So there's that aspect. However, I mean, that this is Agya Chakra as the command center. Agya Chakra is also the psychic center. And what I found in doing this research, which didn't come out now till the mid-80s, when the neuroscientists finally isolated a chemical which was called pinoline, because they thought it was made by the pineal gland. And pinoline is chemically virtually identical with the active chemicals in the sacred vine in ayahuasca. So the sacred vine, Banisteriopsis, has as its active ingredients what are called the Hamala alkaloids, and pinoline is identical with the Hamala alkaloids. And the function that they now think might be happening, although this is still speculation, but they think it might be that pinoline interacts with serotonin, which is found in its greatest quantities in the brain in the pineal gland. And serotonin is a tryptamine. And they think that when serotonin can't degrade properly in its normal way, that it forms various tryptamines, one of which is DMT. DMT has now been isolated in the pineal gland of rat brains, and DMT has been found in the brains and other places in humans. So we know that we have DMT in our body. And it could, this is identical with ayahuasca, which is this mix of the Hamala alkaloid from the sacred vine and DMT from various different plants that they put into the ayahuasca brew. So we are creating ayahuasca in our brains every night. And this could be the trigger for the dream state, because the dream state is a highly hallucinogenic state. And our dreams get longer as the night progresses, and the pinoline and DMT being produced, it's a hypothesis, medical hypothesis, that they are being produced in greater quantities as the night progresses, and that's why our dreams last longer. Until the pineal gland stops functioning at dawn, because it's a creature of the night, stops producing the pinoline, the DMT stops being made, and we enter into our daytime conscious state.
Wow. So is there anything we can do to encourage this synthesis?
I don't know about encouraging the synthesis, but we can certainly learn to become aware of our dreams and do dream yoga and work with our dreams and learn how to be more aware at that level of our being. We don't have to go to South America and do an ayahuasca ritual. We just need to learn to work with our dreams.
So what can we do to help us to work with our dreams?
Well, first of all, learn to remember them. So keep a pad of paper under your pillow with a pencil, and the first thing you do when you wake in the morning is write down whatever is in your head, which might be, damn it, the alarm's gone off, in which case don't use an alarm. And mostly when you first start this, it's feelings. So you have a mood or an emotion that you wake with. And as you get practiced by doing this every single morning, and don't ever have a break, write down every morning. So you then find the images start to come. And then the image will lead you to what the previous image was. And eventually you get to the point of writing your dream down. It works without fail. You just got to be persevering. And once you're writing your dreams down, then you start sharing your dreams with people, just by telling them the dream. And in telling them the dream, you start to get an understanding of what the dream was about. People feeding back to you what the dream brings up for them, that helps you get an understanding. And so gradually you learn to understand the dream language, because it's a different language from our everyday secondary consciousness. It works in different ways. It works in the symbolic archetypal language. So you've got to get to know this mythic language. Once you've got this happening really well, then you can start playing with your dreams. You do dream induction, which is where, as you go to sleep at night, rather than just repeating to yourself, I'm going to remember and record my dreams in the morning, you repeat to yourself, I'm going to dream about such and such and remember and record my dreams in the morning. And then you record your dream and you believe and trust that it is a dream telling you about whatever it is you asked it to tell you about. You've got to trust it. At first, it might not seem very clear. At first, you might not understand the connection. But as you keep doing dream induction, so it gets clearer and clearer until finally your dreams are giving you that level of consciousness understanding about whatever it is you're asking it about. Then you can start playing with it in psychic terms and looking to dream about the future or whatever it might be. Then you can start lucid dreaming, where you learn to become awake and conscious in your dreams. Then you can start doing flying dreams, flying to different places and recording whatever it is you experience at those different places. This is like remote viewing or clairvoyance and so on.
There's plenty of activity there. I must admit, I've been practicing some of those recommendations since I saw you at, I think it was at the Unity Gathering we met last, and I've found them to be very useful. So
They are useful, and it's a good way of learning how to work with that aspect of our consciousness so that you become more familiar with it, and so that the roadway, the route between your conscious mind and your dream mind becomes clearer. You clear it of all the brambles and the thickets and the things that get in the way so that you can actually move between those two worlds with great facility.
It's always been an important part of the day, a very special part of the day for me, that the bit between waking up and engaging with the workaday world as it is. And it's become even more so, I think, since I've started trying to remember my dreams, because I think to start with, it was really just a feeling that there was something useful and special going on, which I could never put my finger on. But it does seem to me to be important to have an hour or so when I can start dipping my toe into the day rather than plunging straight into it as a result of an alarm clock going off.
Well, yes, I totally agree with you. And if we are fortunate enough to be able to run our lives without alarm clocks, then I do recommend it.
And you did say, I think, that last time I was listening to you, that we do actually need to dream.
Yes. Research has shown that you can get all the sleep you want, but if you're not allowed to dream, that you'll start dreaming while awake. And I think that this is one of the triggers for psychotic breakdown.
Because it means you're not actually you can't break out of the dream state to deal with the real world.
Yes, you get trapped in it, which is very scary.
Yeah. And how does the Earth's magnetic field also affect the pinealine and the pineal enzymes, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. Normally the pineal gland is controlled by light and dark, as I mentioned earlier. It switches on at sunset and switches off at sunrise. But research has shown that the pineal gland enzymes, their production is affected by changes in the Earth's magnetic field. And I have a theory that part of the reason that our psychic awareness is affected by changes in the Earth's magnetic field is because the pineal gland's being affected. It's producing its chemicals, taking us into a state of consciousness which is more psi-conducive, and that this is a theoretical understanding for what is going on.
So how does, because it's possible for us, isn't it, to shield ourselves from the Earth's magnetic field, and our ancestors did that as well. How does that affect things?
Well, now when we're talking ancestors doing this, we're talking about the Neolithic people and making the stone circles and the barrows. If you look at the sighting of stone circles, they are all within a mile of a geological fault line. And where you get geological fault lines, you get anomalous geomagnetic activity. The Earth's magnetic activity is stronger by a fault line. And especially when you've got tremors and earthquakes, you get very strong magnetic activity. And the stone circles are often made of stones that are highly magnetic, like we get up at Carn Ingley in the Preseli Hills, the Preseli Bluestones. So they were working with this Earth's magnetic activity, and stone circles, being places of very strong magnetic activity, are therefore places that are going to be areas where you're more likely to have a vision, more likely to see the fairies or a poltergeist, or more likely to be able to give strong healing effects, that sort of thing. Also, in the Neolithic times, they built the long barrows. And the long barrows are constructed of layers of organic and inorganic material. So you've got the stone chambers, over there will be earth, and there'll be more layers of stone, more layers of earth, and quite often they're faced with quartz on the outside. And you go into one of these and it's like going into a Faraday chamber. It cuts out all electromagnetic activity. Try to turn the radio on in a fully sealed chamber and you won't get any radio. And it's the same with all the other electromagnetic spectrum and to a degree with the geomagnetic activity as well. Although you've got to be pretty well shielded for that. So these are places where you're going into areas of quiet activity as opposed to the stone circles where it's more active, where it's stronger, more intense activity. And when you go into areas of quiet activity, this is more related to the receptive side, the clairvoyant, the precognition, the dream type receptive activity. And I think that the barrows were initiation chambers. And if you look at Evans Went's book, Fairy Faith in Celtic Countries, he talks about a chamber in Ireland that right up until the 1800s was still being used for 10-day initiations. That you would go in, the stone would be rolled over the front, and you would spend 10 days in the dark. And I can imagine that you would have pretty strong experiences.
Yes, and apparently that would also, it slightly distorts the effect of time on us, doesn't it? Because although we live by a 24-hour solar day, we seem to have a deeper 25-hour rhythm in us. And isn't that brought out in these places?
Well, if there's still some magnetic activity, yes. Because the Earth's magnetic field is affected, as I mentioned, by the sun with the sunspot cycle, but there's also a daily effect of the moon because of the moon's effect on the tides on, you know, the oceans. And this causes gravitational effects, which affects the Earth's magnetic field. So when we don't have any light at all, we, after about 10 days, it actually takes 10 days to stabilize. After about 10 days, move on to a 25-hour cycle, which is the lunar cycle. And our body clock is this 25-hour cycle. And I think that those of us who are slightly lunatic orientated have this tension between the 24-hour and the 25-hour cycle in our bodies. I know for me, I easily slip into staying up an hour later at night. I find it very hard in the mornings to wake up. I want to carry on for an hour later. So I slip into a 25-hour cycle, even though I'm being affected by the sunlight to wake me up and put me to sleep. I have this, and I think other night owls and other musicians and those sorts of people are very strongly affected by the moon's pull.
Yes, yeah, I must admit, I have to resist the tendency to stay up late into the night and encourage myself, because I gather that there's the sleep we get actually before midnight, if you like, between sort of 9 and midnight, is particularly useful for the settling of our mind into the dream state.
I don't know. I suspect that that whole thing about going to sleep before midnight was initiated by the larks of the universe. The ones who like to get up early.
Yeah,
but I do know that whenever I've stayed in ashrams and monasteries, they're very strong on you going to sleep early and getting up early. Mm. And they consider that getting up to meditate at 3-4 in the morning is the prime time to get up to meditate. And you can only do that if you've gone to bed at 8-9 in the evening. So there might be something to it.
I find that quite interesting as well, because something that I am experiencing quite often nowadays is actually waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning. And when I look at the clock, I see that it's within sort of 10 minutes or so that if I do wake up in the middle of the night, normally it has to be said in a state of some panic that that's when it happens. And it can take me a while to shake the feeling off and go back to sleep again.
Yes. Yes. Well, I think that waking up at 3 o'clock in the morning is actually something to be encouraged if you want to work with these states of consciousness. And if you're waking up with panic, the heart beating and all of that, then it's very good to do some quite relaxed, slow, deep breathing and watch your mind and watch your body and see what is actually the root cause behind it.
Yeah, I think that's very good advice. I do find that the deep breathing is very effective, I must admit.
Yeah, good stomach breathing.
I was getting to a sort of closing point anyway, because that was very interesting and enabled us to cover most of the stuff that I wanted to cover. I have got a copy of your fairy folk book on order though, and hope that there might be another conversation to be had when I've read that.
Oh, most definitely. There's a whole other conversation that we haven't even started on yet.
Yeah.
We got close to it because we got to the Earth Mysteries chapter, and that leads on to the Fairy Faith chapter.
That's right, and there's also the closing chapter of the of where science and magic meet is also truly fantastic. We haven't managed to touch on that. I would just like to touch on the subject of magic though, because you have a chapter called Parapsychology: The Scientific Study of the Tools of Magic.
Yes.
And I wonder if you might like to talk about that a little bit, about aspects of belief and visualization and the trickster.
Yes, well, we talked about belief, haven't we? That the whole thing of attitude being the most important action that you can take. Visualization is key in the Western magical tradition and also in a lot of the meditation traditions. So both the yogic and the Tibetan Buddhist use visualization a lot in their practices. And when we were doing our research with the Tibetans and the yogis, in our questionnaire, we asked about visualization practices. And although it wasn't very strong, we had one series of experiments where the people were asked to either do mantra meditation as their session meditation practice or to do visualization. And whilst the actual practice didn't make any effect in terms of their psychic awareness for that session, those who had done over the years more visualization practice did show stronger psychic effects. So there's something about working with visualization, working with dream mind, working with that aspect of our mind that seems to be quite a good training program for psychic awareness. And it is used a lot within the Western magical mystery traditions.
And they go for visualization, which enables them to imagine. Because I remember I did a bit of this training when I was younger, and the aim was to be able to visualize something, say, with your eyes closed, so with such energy that when you opened your eyes, you could actually see the item you were visualizing in front of you.
Yes, and the Tibetans have this as well. They call it creating a tulpa, and it's also part of the practice for learning how to go out of body at will. So it's used quite extensively. Mm-hmm. Visualization is quite an important tool in those sorts of mental training practices. In terms of the trickster, this is fun.
Yeah.
Because psychic phenomena don't like being caught. They're a bit like a tiger. You don't want to try to catch a tiger. It doesn't like being caught. And so you have to sidle up sideways to them if you're wanting to work with them consciously. And the phenomena will always make a joke. So, for instance, when they were working with Matthew Manning and he was doing his healing work with them, as soon as he stopped trying to do it, the phenomena would happen. You go to record a poltergeist and nothing will happen. In those days, video cameras will run out of tape and immediately something will start to happen. Or the recorder breaks down at the moment that something happens. Yeah, a bit like you mentioned Paulie in his lab and the, you know, machinery not working when he was around. It's so tricksterish, this phenomenon. And in parapsychology, we just learn to work with that. You learn, you've got to have great patience and a great sense of humour.
Yeah. And what about ritual?
You will find that experimenters in parapsychology who get results nearly always have some sort of ritual. Ritual is a way of creating the right ambiance, the right setting, the right emotion, which enables these very tricky, shy phenomena to make their presence felt.
Yeah.
That's what ritual does. It's a psychological gambit. It's a psychological ploy. It's a way of getting a mental environment that is conducive.
Right. I like the way you connected in your book the shamans with that kind of thing, getting people into, because it is an uncertain process, as you say. It's you're not sure, you can't be sure when you're going to capture it and when you're not. And I really like the idea that that shamans use a degree of ritual to presumably increase people's receptiveness, because as we said, attitude was important. And if necessary, they might pull a bit of a trick at the beginning if it was an important thing, just to kind of tip the balance, as it were, tip the scales of belief in the right direction.
Yeah, and you can feel the energy. You know, it might be a trick that's been performed, but everybody's hairs stand on end. It's like, whoa, what's happening? And as soon as you've got that emotional energy, then the real stuff can manifest.
Because, of course, it does.
There was somebody called Ken Batchelder who did table tipping experiments for years in his own home. And he had a thing where somebody would consciously kick the table or something, and everybody else around the table was like, oh, it's moved, and then the table would start to move of its own accord because you've got that energy there. Yeah. And it's the same, the magic of the theater, you know, really good theatrical performance, it takes you out of yourself, and magic, it is magic.
Yes, I use drama a lot as an illustration of how these things can be made to work, because I do the Shakespeare every year at the Living Willow Theatre we've got here. But we've seen theatre companies come here and they're wearing their own clothes, they're using their own name, they're performing basically in the orchard, so they've got none of the theatrical, you know, none of the lights or special effects or anything. And as soon as they start, within 5 minutes, you're drawn completely into a different world by them. I think it's an amazing demonstration of what can be done.
Yes. Yes, I love drama and I love theatre. And it is ritual in its own format.
Oh, yes, certainly that. Well, I know you've got other places to go to, Serena. Thank you very much for that conversation. I really enjoyed that.
You're very welcome indeed. Good. Well, I'm glad we managed to do it. And I once again apologise profusely for double booking myself this evening.
That's okay. Diaries are only a rough guide. That's what I say. And thank you very much for being available this afternoon. That was great.
And I'll, very welcome indeed. Nice talking with you.
Nice talking with you. As soon as the Fairy Law book comes through, I shall read that and then I'll get back in touch with you.
This is Media Streaming International Radio.
That was Hawklords and Psy Power, and before that, Puppet Show by Horace X from their long-playing CD, Strategy. You are, of course, listening to Dr. Rock's radio show on msiradio.com and scotlandisfree.ning.com. And before those tunes, we were listening to a conversation that I had earlier on this afternoon with Serena Roney Dougal on the subject of psychic research and the various intuitive abilities of human beings. Before I go any further, a reminder that coming up in an hour, we've got Freeman Jack's New Horizons show. It's rescheduled from last week. I forgot to promote the show last week, which must mean that I had my precog turned on, because apparently it didn't happen. But this week, he's apparently seeking a new political philosophy, optimal gradualism. He says, having spent years investigating political theory in search of a meaningful alternative, he hopes to present a new political philosophy that frees us from the constraints of existing political dogma. And Lord knows, we could do with a little bit of that, eh? Well, I thought it was pretty striking that, you know, it was evidently quite hard for Serena to find herself on a PhD in parapsychological research. And it seemed to me to be, it was quite amusing and très juste that it was the head of an engineering department who happened to be a member of the, I don't know, Society for Psychical Research, who twisted the arm of the head of psychology to let her do it. I thought that was very funny. And she pointed out at the same time that psychologists don't much like parapsychology. Oh, things can be so difficult, can't they? Some of the experiments she was talking about were a lot more subtle than I'd realised as well. They've obviously been sort of changing over time. I know that there's been a movement really to shift away from people's conscious responses, getting them to actually acknowledge when they're being stared at or something like that, because evidently what we're dealing with here is the sort of subliminal mind, which Serena referred to as really our primary processing mind. She says that it is kind of like the main way that we seem to deal with the world, and that the world of sense is kind of laid over the top of it. And so it is that they now mostly use things like galvanomic skin response, so measuring when people sweat a little bit more, when the heart rate goes up. And it's amazing, isn't it, that that a measurable response is achieved to statistically significant levels by looking for people sweating when they're being watched over a CCTV link from a remote building, which suggests that there's not really any restriction put on this sort of thing by distance, something that's definitely demonstrated by Edgar Mitchell's experiments. He was on one of the Apollo moonshots. I am one of those people who do believe that the Americans went to the moon. I believe they have their own reasons for making us now want to think that they didn't go there, but that's really, I think, a subject for a whole other show. But assuming they did happen, Edgar Mitchell was one of the astronauts, and he did some surreptitious psi experiments up there. It wasn't actually on the program as it was. I'm sure nobody's really surprised about that. But I believe that he was using a set of cards which had designs on them of some sort. And when he was supposed to be asleep, he was kind of fiddling his way through these cards and trying to get a receiver on Earth to guess which card it was that he was looking at. I think this was a fairly common experiment for a while. And apparently, as Serena said, it was a very successful experiment. And that means that far from being watched by a remote camera in a remote building, he was actually on the other side of the moon. So he was not only a long way away, but he had quite a substantial object in between him and his target. But it seems to have worked pretty well. And the Institute of Noetic Sciences are well worth looking into. They've done some extremely interesting research, published a lot of papers, and of course, Dean Radin, who we heard from earlier in the show, is one of their senior scientists. I hadn't realised either until I was speaking with Serena that they'd started using telepathic monitoring of the double slit experiment. This is the experiment where they try firing a single photon at a time at a pair of slits, and they're hoping to find out just exactly what the photon does, whether it goes through one slit or the other, or what happens. And the result was that they were getting an interference pattern on a screen behind the two slits, which meant there was a kind of bright white line in the centre, followed by grades of slightly fainter white lines at equal distances either side of the central line. This caused a fair degree of confusion, because, of course, being as there's only one photon going through at a time, it shouldn't be possible for there to be any interference, because there's nothing for it to interfere with apart from itself. And I know that in the original early experiments for this, they actually set up physical monitoring devices to try and find out what was going on. And at that point, the photon refused to behave like a wave anymore and started, or refused to behave like a particle anymore and whatever. It's, was not consistent. Well, it was just no longer doing what they expected it to do. So the setting up of the observing device effectively seems to have changed the behavior of the photon. I think it's even more amazing that psychic researchers have apparently now set it up so that they're trying to use telepathy to monitor, again, a remote telepath somewhere in another building, trying to monitor what's going on. And getting the same results as if a physical measuring system was set up. It's also good to hear remote viewing kind of validated and commented upon by a professional firsthand. That was one of the things I read about many years ago. I mentioned his name, Russell Targ. The tales I read was that he was effectively employed by the FBI, who wanted to know whether remote viewing was possible, and they set him a bunch of targets, and his laboratory was genuinely, it would appear, extremely successful at these things. So successful, in fact, that the FBI became convinced that he actually had a man on the inside, and I think they spent the next 2 or 3 years watching him to see how it was he was doing it. Just another example of denial, I guess, in officialdom when you're getting good results. I thought it was quite interesting that one of the conclusions that's being reached is that all psychic phenomena, near as damn it, are thought to be now precognition. I think there's still work going on that. But it means that the time thing that we're all so enslaved to, all of us wearing our watches and going to work at a given time, coming home at a given time, it does seem that at a fairly fundamental level, time is not what we think it is. And one of the experiments she was talking about with the yogis or the monks involved remote viewing, i.e. trying to identify a video clip, I think it was then, but it's done with groups of pictures as well. And in some of the experiments, the target picture or video clip was selected before the experiment was done, and in some of them it was picked afterwards. And there was no statistical difference between the two results, suggesting that both of them are to some extent precognitive results. And what about the meditating and praying for people who are being healed? Again, quite spectacular results to do with people who'd had cardiac arrest, people that had AIDS, really quite significant apparently physical problems that can be the curing of which, or the healing of which, the amelioration of which, shall we say, so we don't get ourselves into trouble, can be affected just by the mental attention of a group of other people. And of course we know now as well that these sort of effects can work even in surgery, that so long as enough care is taken to ensure that the patient believes the surgery's been done, when you get a couple of years down the line, there's no statistically significant difference between the group that's operated on and the group that hasn't been operated on. So there certainly seems to be some non-material mental psychological elements in this which would be well worth our paying attention to, because might save us a lot of money, might save a lot of pain, might save a lot of inconvenience if we could work out how to do these things on more people. And seeds, blessing your seeds, apparently makes for bigger plants. It makes them resistant to fungal disease. Those are both pretty useful things to be able to do. And the word she used there was, she says they were blessed by a healer, these plants. And there are, of course, now whole books out there on the art of blessing. I can't remember the name of, I read one of them, a man who decided that rather than cursing people, he was going to go around just blessing everybody he came across, and does seem to be getting really, at least anecdotally, quite spectacular results. Again, I remember hearing a tale of a lady who had a handbag nicked, had it snatched off her on a railway station, and she'd been reading the blessing book, so she decided to bless the guy that had just removed her nominal property. And apparently the result was that he kind of stopped in his tracks and turned round and gave her the handbag back. I don't know that he actually heard the blessing or what have you, but certainly might be worth trying with the seeds. It might even be worth trying, of course, with people. Can be used for good or bad. You can anti-bless people as well as bless them. Works with the, obviously, the placebo effect is not normally called into use by the medical fraternity. In fact, quite often I suspect that the kind of diagnosis that they're giving in fact induces the nocebo, as I call it, the placebo's shadow twin. And another, I think, very important point that Serena made was that by being angry with somebody, you do physically affect them. And every time I hear about anger nowadays or witness its effect on people, it does make me think about the kind of programming that's running in a lot of the TV shows that I see. The one that always springs to my mind, not that I've seen it for a long, long time now, but in the early years when it was on, EastEnders certainly seems to be full of very, very angry people being very, very angry with each other. And perhaps it is that we're causing significant damage by doing that. So our attempts to remain peaceful for our own reasons and to get our own results may well be doing the world a favour in far, far wider sense. I think it's also interesting that meditators, skilled meditators, are much more capable of pulling off these kind of psychic stunts than people who've got either no or very little meditative experience. She said that as you stop the chatter, so you become more aware of the subtler levels of mind. And with meditation, we can move beyond the normal sense processes. In fact, she said that some of the most advanced meditators were 100% reliable in terms of their precognitive abilities. I gather as well, I think I heard that the American Navy have managed to come up with some protocols based on some of this stuff, which enable them to ensure that their people, when trained in these protocols, can approach, say, a fork in the road. And by accessing these abilities more or less in the moment, they can be more or less sure, I think the figure was 98-99% sure, that with no further information than their own intuition, that they're going to be able to pick the most advantageous fork down which to travel, which would be an extremely useful thing to do, just like being able to make your seeds grow bigger and resist fungal damage. And the dream mind seems to be the primary mind, pure mind without the senses. Very interesting that newborn babies dream 70% of the time, I thought. And the question, what are they dreaming about, is a very good question. For a long time, I was led to believe that our dreaming was basically processing of stuff that had happened to us during the day or the week or the month or whatever, and what we were doing was kind of juggling it about to try to come up with some sort of result. And I think there is an element of that in our dreams, but clearly your newborn baby, if he spends 70% of his time dreaming, hasn't had that much stuff to sort out. Or maybe he has. Maybe it really is something that needs a lot of dreaming about, arriving from a nice, warm, beaty place out into this cold world. I'd like to know a little bit more about the Dragon Project, this business of dreaming on sacred sites. I spoke with Lawrence Main on that subject some weeks ago because he was also part of that subject. It appears that these places, the sacred sites, the stone circles and the avenues and barrows, are all almost designed to enhance these psychic abilities, and it is something that Synchro and I are hoping to give a go next year once things warm up a little bit. Take our little one-man tent out there and have a go at sleeping at some of these places. Serena said that the vast majority of the stone circles in Albion are placed within a mile or so of geological faults. Albion's quite an interesting place because it carries all sorts of rocks from geological history. We've apparently got samples of almost everything here. So there's many different opportunities for placing a stone circle either here or there for different reasons. But the vast majority of them, I think it was Paul Devereux's work, the man who ran the Dragon Project, that showed that this is the case. And statistical processing apparently tells us that there's a significantly less than a million to one chance that these circles were put there just by accident. Serena said that these stone circles are magnetically and electromagnetically charged, and that as such they maximise our access to things like psychic experiences. A piece in a book which is about the Dream Project and about the stone circles. Yeah, here it is. Excuse me a moment. developing the first of the winter colds here. It says there's less than a 1 in a million chance that the stone circles were placed on these specific areas of geological faulting at random. The stone circles have been placed on specific rock outcrops. These rocks are extensively faulted, and the geological faults are all areas of tectonic stress leading to piezoelectric effects and geomagnetic anomalies, and this means they are places of unusual psychic power. Every stone circle in England and Wales is within a mile of a surface fault or lies on an associated intrusion. Measurements of unusual physical effects associated with megalithic stones have been made using Gauss meters, which have shown anomalous magnetic readings near the stones compared to the locality. For example, Eduardo Balanowski detected with a Gauss meter several anomalies in the magnetic field around the stone Menhir at Cracow. Cooper has measured radioactive levels with a Geiger counter, and certain areas around the site have yielded above average counts. It appears that an ionisation effect is being recorded. At the Rollright Stones, where much of the Dragon Project research took place, audio-sonic equipment measured a high-pitched sonic outburst from the stones just at the moment of dawn, and infrared photography showed the same energy burst from the stones at the moment of dawn. Several well-known and well-respected dowsers, for example Bill Lewis, have also measured unusual effects. This effect has also been noticed by ornithologists recording bats near to ancient sites, so there is some interaction between the stone and the energising effect of light first hitting it, a truly 2001 phenomenon. Robbins thinks that the stone crystal lattice gives some sort of semiconductor effect. At sunrise, only the shorter wavelength visible and infrared radiation is clearing the horizon, and it is this that creates the ultrasound effect in the stone monuments. The stones seem to act as some sort of capacitor, which is discharged when the light first hits them. In other words, because many of the British stone circles are built on quartz-bearing granite intrusions and are themselves built out of ancient quartz-bearing stone, the whole circle is surrounded by unusual geomagnetic fields, and static electric, sonic, and infrared discharges occur when such activity as dawn or hand pressure touches the stones. Because we are electromagnetic beings, we obviously interact with the electrical energies of the stones, and touching them causes pressure on them and an electric discharge occurs. So that's quite a bevy of things that are occurring at the Rollright Stones, which is you wouldn't think. I mean, looking at it, it's not as spectacular as Stonehenge or Castle Rigg. A lot of the stones are sort of almost buried in the ground, but nonetheless, they seem to be pretty active. In fact, the stones there are so difficult to detect that it is said that no two people will be able to count the same number of stones if they try to work your way around. In fact, it's quite difficult even for one individual to count the same number of stones twice, because I've tried it a few times, that being a stone circle that is close to one of my favourite breweries. Serena mentioned big dreaming as well, which is something that I don't think I've really touched on before, but there do seem to be different sorts of dream that become apparent in our nighttime's rest. There's the kind of chaotic and disorderly dreams that are not necessarily always very memorable. And then there's dreams where one wakes up feeling that something has really happened, that one has experienced something of a shamanic undertaking, as it were. And she says that these big dreams are us entering the archetypal consciousness, which exists outside space and time. She referred specifically to underworld dreams, which are very common, but there are many other sorts. And then it is that we're dreaming about our soul's journey, if you like, dreaming on a bigger canvas. And she gave several bits of advice, which I think might bear repeating in terms of those of us who want to start trying to remember our dreams and starting to understand the subconscious messages that are coming to us from them. She said that one of the things that it's good to do is to, before you go to bed at night, say, I'm going to remember and record my dreams in the morning. I seem to remember that when this came up in a question and answer session at her talk at the Unity Gathering, that she said it was worth doing that. I think it was a couple of dozen times, really repeating to your mind, making sure that the conscious mind says to the unconscious mind, this is what I want to do. And then it's a kind of a growth of memory, really, from there, apart from the big dreams, which I tend to think that if, so long as you don't open your eyes, look out the window before you try to remember the dream, they tend to be close enough to the surface to remember them anyway. But the many other dreams we dream every night, apart from Mahatma Coach, who doesn't dream, apparently, for, it seems, good reasons. When we first start doing this kind of investigation, it's feelings that we're going to wake up with in the morning rather than images and the like. And that was certainly my experience, was that in the period when I was coming out of sleep, that there was a sense that something had gone on, as it were, but no actual narrative, no actual picture or image, nothing, if you like, to really hang that feeling off. Once again, as with the meditation, it's perseverance and consistency that's emphasized here. She did say that it's important to do this every morning and to stick with it, because that's what the wider experience grows out of. And she said that after a while of doing this, that the feelings would start developing into images. You'd start to see images. And I've certainly found that if I wake up with an image from a dream, something that I can actually remember, if I just lie still and concentrate for a while, then it's fairly easy quite often to relate other images from the same dream. And if it's then written down, it's there for future reference. It is also true that even doing that work for me, if I even do the work of remembering the images and tying them together a little bit before I open my eyes, if I don't write it down, then by breakfast time it does disappear. And that can happen even with quite the spectacular dreams, I think. She was careful to emphasize that this method does work without fail, that it is a practice a bit like meditation, which, if applied, will yield results that are worth having. Next, she said, was important was telling others about the dream, because I guess speaking things into the outside world makes them more memorable anyway, just like writing them down does. That was something that we heard about in the show we did about learning, was that writing stuff down helps, teaching other people helps remember things. So talking to other people about dreams, it not only helps remember them, but it also helps us to understand the dream, because I guess we get to see it from a different perspective. And by talking to other people about it, we start to understand the archetypal language of the dream world, which Serena said was quite different from the world that we normally occupy in our wakeful hours. And once you got to the point where you can actually remember your dreams, can talk about them with other people, she said that you can start to program them. You can start to look for given results. And that's something I've spoken about before. I know probably two or three times now. is setting a problem, asking a question, seeking an answer on the way to sleep, and making sure that the subconscious mind is aware that you are seeking some kind of solution. And it's amazing how often that works, and it's amazing how often how clear and obvious the answer can be as well. Sometimes the answer is not so clear, and Serena emphasized that it was important to realize that whatever it is that comes through is, in some sense, the answer to what we're seeking, that it is worthy of attention. And that's something I've found maybe takes 2 or 3 days. It might take another night's dreaming to sort out what the previous night's dreaming is trying to tell me. But by and large, once it's written down and can be remembered and looked at again, it is possible for understanding of what's going on to develop. And then she says eventually move on to lucid dreaming, which is what I was talking about with synchro last week, the ability to become conscious in the dream state and to have some control over what's going on, over the creation that is occurring in the non-material world of our sleep. And she says that this process basically ensures that the roadway between the conscious mind and the dream mind becomes clearer of brambles, and it becomes easier for us to walk. And as we were talking about last week, it seems that there's a link between the ability to create the world that we're seeking in our dreams and being able to create the world that we're seeking in our waking dreams. And visualization itself as well helps strengthen psychic awareness. I used to find the visualization thing quite difficult because I was trying to do three-dimensional objects, things like matchboxes and stuff like that. It's easier to do it with a simple object, but I found that one of the things that is fairly easy to visualize with a little bit of practice is geometry, because it has a kind of regularity to it, and also because there seems to be something within us that recognizes it. And it seems also to me to be fairly easy to imagine, visualize, if you like, simple geometric shapes like a circle or a triangle or a square, something that's nice and regular. And once you've got the hang of that sort of thing, it gets a little bit easier to manage the three-dimensional geometry, and again, can work your way up from the simple to the more complex. So that was tonight's chat with Serena. I think I'm getting a bit of a sore throat here, so I think that I have got some more stuff to say on the subject, but I think I might actually tidy it up a little bit, because one of the things that Serena goes into in the book in a little bit of detail is the connection between these psychic and intuitive skills and the discoveries of quantum physicists. And it's certainly worth 15 or 20 minutes look at some of the crossover, if you like, between modern physical theory and modern theories of mind. But I can really get to feel my throat getting a little bit tired here, so I think I'd probably better do myself and you a favour and probably play some tunes. I am hoping, as you heard at the end of that particular interview, to get Serena back, because I've got a copy of her fairy lore book on order, which there's a whole chapter on that in Where Science and Magic Meet, which is in itself absolutely fascinating, because it seems to suggest that there's a whole layer of mythology that we've been disencouraged from reading. It's all been kind of replaced by the Greek and Roman stuff, and that in itself is another interesting matter, and it's somewhere where I sense that Serena's real interest lies in that particular subject. And in that process, we'll probably talk about the emerging relationship between science and mysticism, as well as various connections between it and the Vedas and Buddhism. But right now, I'm going to call the talking bit of it quits for the night. As I say, in half an hour's time, hopefully we'll have Freeman Jack coming to join us for his New Horizons show. In the meantime, here's half an hour or so's tunes. Thanks to everybody for being out there, of course, and thanks to MSI Radio for continuing after all this time to let me come on here and do all of this. And I reckon, all things being equal, I'll be back with you next week. So here's Catatonia and Strange Glue, because strange glue indeed it is.